he is known for winning a lot of battles, but also for establishing many cities. And the main reason that we know him so well is because he established many cities, such as the city of Alexandria in Egypt, although he named many cities Alexandria, or the like. There are a lot of cities that there are several cities named Alexandria, but
you would too if you conquered half the world at the time.
And it actually is interesting to think about that, because while he was able to conquer a lot of the known world, his empire didn't last. And as soon as he died, his empire was split between four of his generals, who then in turn fought amongst each other. And then from there, it kind of dwindled and separated into different parts. And none of them were as great as Alexander. And it's interesting because if you hold this up to the idea of, you know, the Golden Age, you have the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and then you have the, you know, the Iron Age, which is the worst, you can see that Alexander's empire kind of follows the exact same progression. But one of the biggest, you could say, results of Alexander's empire is the spread of the Greek and the establishment of all the cities was the spread of the Greek language and the creation of basically established trade networks, a common set of weights and measures, a common set of language, and to some degree, a common set of philosophy. This led to a lot of things in history, but to put it in perspective, the next kind of great empire on the scene, which people consider is usually the Roman Empire, and then to do away with all of Roman history for a moment, just as this article is, after the Roman Empire, at the end of the Roman Empire, we have a split between East and West. And what most people, when they think about the split, they basically consider that Rome ends as a civilization. And the reason that they think this is because, well, this is when the Romans stopped using Latin. So when the Eastern and Western Roman Empire split, Constantine moves the capital of Rome from Rome to a city which he names after himself, Constantinople, which becomes the capital of what we call the Byzantine Empire, but which Constantine called essentially just Rome, the true Roman Empire. And that empire lasts for about 1,000 years. Historically, what that gets us in terms of feelings, I know Constantinople was founded in about the year 300 something, so I think that makes the end of the Byzantine Empire around 1300. What I want to bring to attention there is that what we see here is the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, they're creating much longer civilizations. And the Islamic Golden Age, which you mentioned as well, also brought a longer period of prosperity and continuity for a group of peoples than had previously been seen in that part of the world. So we're seeing, if we just take a step back historically, what we can see here is that the idea of progress from empire to empire is that, well, we're seeing that these empires are lasting longer, that they're getting more technologically and culturally complex. There is also religious changes, and those are having changes on how people think and behave. And so, yeah, we're seeing a lot of changes if we look at those historical developments. But most importantly, we're seeing that empires are lasting longer. So the idea that an empire can improve, in a sense, during its golden age, for lack of a better word, before it starts to decline, is becoming more seen.
Yeah, and again, what's interesting about that is maybe, in a technical sense, the people that we're talking about didn't have a scholarly division dedicated to progress, right? So maybe they didn't conceptualize progress in the same way. That being said, well, I mean, you know, it's important to distinguish whether or not we're applying our concept of progress, mapping it onto previous civilizations, or whether we're looking at it through their lens. So maybe it's the case that they didn't conceptualize progress in the same way, and so we can't say that they had a scholarship of progress, or we map our own thoughts about it onto them and say, here is progress, right? So I think it's important to make that distinction. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's impossible almost to have an empire that lasts 1,000 years and not to be a citizen in it that, let's say your grandparents, you know, didn't have access to aqueducts, and then you're the first generation with an aqueduct in your city, or, you know, that's progress, right? And I think that's intuitively people can grasp onto that, right? So though progress may not be conceptualized in the same way in terms of a linear upward progression of humanity, if not linear, at least, you know, upward trending progress of humanity from where we are now to where we're wanting to go in terms of how we, our well-being, our technology, our access to knowledge and resources, whatever qualifications you want to put in there, I think what's important to recognize is that you can identify progress, but there may not be necessarily the same way to think about it that is, that exists over time. So that's kind of what we see there. But you did mention religious changes, so maybe we should drop into that next paragraph here, because that starts to explain that a little bit.
So after Plato and Aristotle, and I'm reading directly from an article here, after Plato and Aristotle, the most influential early philosopher is Saint Augustine of Hippo. In The City of God Against the Pagans, Augustine presents a radically new Christian vision of human history. Some humans, God's elect, are predestined for heaven. The rest of humanity is predestined for damnation. Those who are saved belong to the city of God, and those who are damned beings belong to the city of man. Augustine rejects the cyclical accounts of human affairs for a linear one. He is especially concerned to repudiate the doctrine of eternal recurrence, which says that events identical in all respects repeat over and over again. He emphasizes that the birth, death, and resurrection of Christ are unique occurrences and compares the history of the elect to an individual life. Insofar as it is linear, Augustine's narrative of salvation resembles the doctrines of progress, but his emphasis on the city of God contrasts with the worldly inclusive vision of theorists of progress. As we will see, these theorists are concerned with humanity as a whole rather than with a part of it, and thus their focus is on earth rather than on heaven.
Yeah. So I think this is really interesting because St. Augustine, who was who lived in the 4th century, was born in the 4th century of the Common Era, so another 800 years after Plato, already starts to, as it says, mention or to theorize on a theory of progress that is linear as opposed to cyclical, which is very interesting. But as it mentions, it's linear with an end point, right? Because if we're talking about the Christian doctrine, about Christian theology, we're talking about the sacrifice of one's earthly delights to attain station in, you know, heaven, in the afterlife, right? So it's linear in the sense of maybe he is talking about society as a whole, but he's talking about a select group in society who go from here to a better place, right, to heaven, and some people end up in a worse place. And so already, and what I think is really interesting is this idea that he really does, he repudiates the doctrine of eternal recurrence, which is that events are identical in all respects and repeat over and over. So he's essentially giving us this: history does not even rhyme, history moves forward, right? And moves forward towards the kingdom of heaven, which is very different already from what we were seeing before. And I'm curious, though, whether you agree that this resembles the doctrine of progress, as this suggests. I assume it means the modern doctrine of progress. Again, the citation, insofar as it is linear, Augustine's narrative of salvation resembles doctrines of progress. I'm curious what you think of that.
This article is primarily concerned with the modern notions of progress as they are currently understood, I believe, like within the current literature. So, I could preface that with the current modern literature. So this article is not trying to, you know, reinvent the wheel, so to speak. It's not trying to explore notions of progress and like be a philosophical essay on what the ideal of progress should be. It's essentially trying to summarize the ideas in the current literature. So
yeah, well,
when it's talking about doctrines of progress, that's kind of my feeling and my take on it.
Yeah. What do you think of this idea though, that it's similar insofar as it is linear?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's a curious thought. I think it's impossible. I don't think you're going to be very credible if you're trying to posit a view of progress that is linear. Because I think it's very clear that humanity, different cultures, different societies go through rise and decline, that empires fall, that there are periods, there are worse periods and better ones, right? And if you want to split it up amongst sort of geographical or ethnic lines, I suppose you could make an argument like that, but I'm more interested in humanity as a whole, right? And so if we're talking about humanity as a whole, we have radically progressed, to, let's say technologically, for example, over the last couple of hundred years, as Mikey was mentioning, perhaps at the expense of some other forms of progress. Progress like how to best take care of our planet, or how to best take care of people who are, you know, radically, where there exists radical inequality in access to resources or any of this kind of thing. So I'm not convinced that Augustine's narrative actually represents progress as it really shows itself in our society ever, including today.
And I think that's very true. Whenever you're comparing ideas, you can never get a real comparison. It's not like when you're comparing numbers, you can just say, you know, 3 is bigger than 2. It's always an inaccurate comparison and kind of a approximation. So I don't think that Augustine's narrative of salvation, this simplified one-sentence form of it, is it compatible with the theories of progress which we have today? Probably not in any way, shape, or form, which is what the article says in the very next sentence. But in terms of a linear notion of progress, I remember at the end of our last show, Michael talked about the idea of universal human rights. And so today, there is an organization that many people know as the United Nations, who have been very famous in drafting many documents talking about the rights of individuals with regards to many different things in many different contexts and many different situations. And then they have essentially gotten delegates from most of the world's nations, or all the world's nations, to agree to these declarations. And so essentially what we've more or less been created is a universal standard of what human rights should be by this international body of the United Nations. And so Michael was saying, well, you know, this vision of human rights, which we have, moving towards that is progress. Moving towards that vision of human rights is progress. Philosophically speaking, how do we know that's progress? Like, where did we get the idea that creating an international body and getting them to decide on a code of laws became progress? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah.
I think something very interesting to tie in here is that even at the very beginning in pre-Enlightenment thought, where we see the ideas of progress is with regards to laws. Essentially, laws are the marker of how much civilization has progressed, is whether it has laws and what kind of laws it has.
That is interesting, hey, because it almost seems as if progress is a series of people deciding that something is a better outcome than another, and then creating some method by which to enforce that vision on a wide scale. To Mikey's point, he was talking a lot about whether or not we could ever... I think there's a bit of a confusion around the term incommensurable. Commensurable meaning comparable to one another. Nonetheless, what he was implying is that we might never reach a point where we all agree on something that should be considered progress, so that he was cynical about that, or he was skeptical about that. But I don't think that's the issue. Clearly, progress is a matter of getting people to do progress, not getting people to believe progress. That's how I see it, is that you can progress. If you have a vision for change, for benefiting some people's lives, you're never going to have a mathematical formula that tells you X amount of children with disabilities that get to go to school, you know, is worth exactly twice as much as X, you know, school boards that have to find and pay extra money to make their schools more accessible. You know what I mean? Like, you're never going to get a formula that tells you that kind of thing, and you're never going to get everyone to agree on exactly the method you should employ or even the values at the core of it. But I think what makes progress, and I think the reason we can identify progress as far back as we want in human history, is a series of changes exist, enforced, as we talked about, in large part by laws that allow a society to change over time towards a view of betterment, regardless of whether that view of betterment changes over time. And so, yes, I get, you could argue that, you know, what if we're just moving in a bad direction and every change that's made is actually a detriment to us in some way? Given where we are now compared to where the ancient Greeks were, I think we can say that we've moved in a generously good direction in a lot of ways.
And that's kind of the interesting thing here, is that the modern individual, or at least us as modern individuals in our country, in our context, we are essentially like, we have to believe in progress. It's something that at this point seems like it's just part of our identity as individuals, to believe that our civilization progressed from other civilizations, and at least in some ways is better than the past. That idea is just ubiquitous. It's everywhere in our society today. The question becomes, is that a justifiable ideal, or a justifiable idea? And where does it come from, and how is it defined? Another thing that we talked about was justice.
Yeah.
On the last show. And I think that's, and Michael specifically brought up John Rawls' idea of justice, which required essentially the consent of individuals in society.
Yeah.
And I'm not incredibly familiar with it. I'm not sure if you are, but I thought that is an interesting thing to think about, is that for a law to exist in a society, it essentially has to be accepted by the society in somehow. So even though you can have laws that are unjust, there are essentially always, in any society, there are some laws that you could just never get a certain society to accept. Like, a society would rather dismantle itself than accept a certain set of new laws. And I think, well, a perfect example would be if someone in Canada said, okay, you know, we should dust off the Athens Constitution and now run Canada by the Athenian Constitution. I think Canadians would not accept that at all. The idea that we should, you know, give up our current legal system for one of created hundreds or thousands of years ago by a totally different civilization in a totally different context would be absurd to us. In the modern day, when we talk about other civilizations who have a better happiness index or a better government system in some regards, in that sense, it's like, okay, well, if they have a better government system than ours, we'll accept that. If it's an older government system, which we have no evidence that it will work better, then there's no way we would accept that. I think that's kind of the intuition of progress. That's a really good example of the intuition of progress, which we all have as a feeling that, oh, I would never accept this, but, oh, a better government? Yeah, I would be okay with a better government.
That is interesting. That is something that it's a good reply to what I was saying previously, because there, I may say we've gotten to a better place, but who's to say? Technologically, perhaps empirically, there are some ways that we can measure that we've come to a better place, but are we better human beings? Are we better ethical beings? Are we, you know, better thinkers, better learners? These are things that we can't know firsthand. And I think it's fair to say that I'm acting on that ubiquitous sort of intuition when I say that we are the product of progress and therefore must be better than whatever came before. So I appreciate you calling me out on that. And that being said, this awareness, I think the article is right to say that this kind of awareness may not, either the awareness was not as prevalent pre-enlightenment, or it was even more deeply rooted such that there was not even a question of whether or not people were moving forward, let's say, or whether they were moving in cycles or whatever the predominant theory is. Maybe that wasn't even called into question in these societies pre-enlightenment. So maybe there's a level of awareness of societal metacognition almost that we can point to as solid evidence of progress between us and people that came before. Maybe we're just being presumptuous and those thoughts and those thought experiments did exist before us and we have no way of knowing. But you're right to say that there are some, it's interesting what we would accept and what we wouldn't accept at all on some pretty almost arbitrary bases. We'll argue about old white men that died, you know, 500 years ago, but not 2000 years ago.
It's a difficult question and to think about where we get our conception of history, because, and I think the first section of this article had a really, really good point, which is that in order to have a theory of progress, you have to basically state, you know, a universal history and kind of connect the dots for people and say, you know, like this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and this was progress. And then this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and that was decline, or that was that was regress. But then, you know, this happened, this happened, this happened, and then we had progress again. And so it's like, okay, well, then, you know, we have a cyclical pattern where, you know, good things happen, bad things happen, because you can't always have good things or bad things happening for something to continue to exist. You expect some variance there. But then overall, there's a trend towards something different. In the last one, they brought up several theories. Specifically, they brought up the thinkers Marx and Kant. So the content of laws of progress, however, is an object of contention. Many thinkers, including Hegel and Auguste Comte, view the development of ideas over time as the fundamental change that causes overall improvement. Marx, in contrast, regards the growth of the means of production as primary. Kant represents a third category, arguing that attention within human nature itself is the source of change. We will also see theorists who offer more eclectic causal stories because their accounts of change are more complicated and are less inclined to formalize their conclusions. To summarize everything we've been talking about in pre-Enlightenment thought, it's not clear whether or not humanity has always had a sense of progress. According to this article, essentially, that was not the case prior to the Enlightenment. Prior to the Enlightenment, we did not have the concept of progress that we have in the modern day. Does that mean that some of the components of modern progress weren't present in ancient societies, or perhaps present in some societies and not present in others? That's possible. It's possible there were some components, but in the modern day, we've developed something new and different from what existed in the past. Now, how that is new and different, we'll be talking about once we get into the Enlightenment. If we take the last part on laws of progress into consideration again, we were left in the last show on the question of to what extent are the laws of progress deterministic values, or are they matters of choice and contingency?
That's an interesting one.
Mm-hmm. And then some of the theorists frame their generalizations as loose trends that constrain rather than determine the course of events, and some authors of the latter category present their writings as political interventions that can shape the future as well as predict it. So,
yeah,
political intervention and the creation of laws seem like they'd have some common overlaps.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's what's really interesting about the ancients. That's why I really enjoy studying pre-Enlightenment, or let's say ancient thought from antiquity, is that there really is this view that, at least the view that things are non-contingent, is a lot more prominent. For example, we talked about the idea that history is cyclical, right? We talked about the idea that Plato and Aristotle brought up, that things are unstable, but that they will repeat themselves, and that there is, for example, the gods are the caretakers of mankind, though now in this age have left them to their own devices, right? So there's very much this idea that progress is, at least in some degree, out of our hands, because things will repeat and things will always be constrained by similar limitations to the ones that we currently see. And I think that's what really makes the difference here, is that today we think progress is up to us. The way we progress as human beings and become better, and what we bring to our society as a result of those efforts, that's all up to us. And that's non-contingent, and that's something that can and does change and improve over time. And so that's what I think is really the important distinction here between the ancient thought and our thought. Who knows? I mean, it's possible that there are elements of that non-contingency that could be relevant to us in study, in terms of seeing how history might indeed repeat itself, how the laws that we make are similar to laws that have always been around, and how those laws might change in response to different variables in societies. And there's an element of it that's freeing, and at the same time puts the responsibility on our shoulders, right, to be the agents of progress. So that if there's one thing that really strikes me as different between the two, it's that. Is it up to us, or is it up to the community and the gods and whatever else, other factors that we attribute it to?
I think that's a pretty good place to end on for this episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and I've been joined by Mihai Kvasser. Thank you so much for listening.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com. Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. It's Burnaby.
This is Bird Note. To join the Great Backyard Bird Count, one of the biggest community science events of the year, you don't even need a backyard. You just need 15 minutes and an interest in birds. Over the course of 4 days in February, the Great Backyard Bird Count gathers heaps of info about birds all over the world and helps people connect with their local birds. If you're new to identifying birds, you can download the Merlin Bird ID app to help figure out which species you're encountering based on looks and sound. If you already recognize your neighborhood birds, you can use eBird to submit a list of every species you see or hear during the count. And you can submit as many checklists as you want during the event. It's a great opportunity to bring friends or family along with you to the backyard or a nearby park, and help them have their first birding experience. You'll submit a shared checklist with all the species you observed as a group. The event begins tomorrow and ends on Monday. Learn more at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Are you inspired? Do you want to be? Tune in to The Arts Edge with Annie Roach, Saturdays from 6 to 7 p.m. and hear stories of artists and educators, writers, painters, actors, people from all walks of life. hear how people are making their lives happen. You can find us at CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Mountain. We're at TELUS HD channel 7014, or you can find us on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. Tune in to The Arts Edge and be inspired.